1963 was a prosperous and relatively quiet year for the American Jewish community. Congregational and communal activity continued in its familiar direction. There was continuing concern expressed that Judaism was, for many, a sociological label rather than a spiritual love. But there was also evidence that an increasing minority of American Jews were concerning themselves with the depths and the duties of their faith. During 1963, American Jews went about the business of citizenship with a becoming confidence. Early on in the year, there were some pressures brought to break the near unanimity of the American Jewish community in regards to the doctrine of the separation of church and state. But 66 of our organizations joined in presenting a friend of the court brief before the United States Supreme Court when the issue of the reading of the Bible as a religious exercise and the recitation of the Lord's Prayer in the public schools came before that body. Fortunately, when the court reaffirmed the high wall of separation, the reaction of the religious community of America was relatively mild. Some concern was expressed also during the year that the interest of individual Jews and of Jewish organizations in the civil rights movement might result in increasing community tensions. Anti-Semitism has always been a plank of the hatred groups of America, and as was to be expected, some ugly words were spoken and other ugly words were scrawled on placards which were held before television cameras. But by and large, given the depths of the passions, the emotional spillover against the Jew was relatively shallow. The American Jewish community can be proud of the strength and the leadership which it lent to the civil rights undertaking at all levels of this crusade. This is not to say that there was no anti-Semitism evident in the United States in 1963. It is to say that anti-Semitism no longer traumatized the American Jew. He was able to accept what evidence remains of it, to deal with it emotionally, psychologically, and to go on about his work. Beyond these shores, Jewish life was not so placid. There were no major communal dislocations during 1963, but the floodgates of exodus and of emigration continued open. The Algerian Jewish community, which had numbered in the days before Algerian independence some 130,000 souls, was reduced by the year's end to less than 10,000 people. The bulk of these had been repatriated to France, and many had subsequently emigrated to Israel. Israel received during 1963 some 60,000 new settlers. They came from widely separated areas of our globe, from Romania and Poland, from Egypt and Morocco, and the Congo and Cuba. The immemorial pilgrimage of the uprooted still went on, but we could take some comfort in the fact that there was now a secure haven at the end of the long road. If there were no new dislocations during 1963, there were, however, several danger signals hoisted, which we could not overlook. The Jewish community of the Argentine is today the fifth largest Jewish settlement in the world. During 1963, as in the previous several years, It was scandalized by a number of violent attacks by a group of young toughs known as the Takuara. Takuara is a bamboo spear, one of the native weapons of the Argentine Indian. The Takuara are a group of young delinquents who have taken over a Nazi fascist ideology. And during the year, they machine gunned and strafed a number of Jewish synagogues and organizational buildings, and they molested and attacked a number of Jewish youth and of the elderly. What was disturbing about these attacks was not the presence of violence and delinquency in the community, so much as the inability or the unwillingness of the authorities to cope with it, to arrest the violent and the malefactor. Frank anti-Semitism has been a public program of the ultramontane right in the Argentine for a number of years. The Takuara received covert and overt support from certain circles within the aristocracy of wealth, within the military, and even within the Catholic Church. The government did not feel itself sufficiently secure to attack the right wing directly on this issue, and therefore the violence went largely unrestricted. As so often has been the case in Jewish history, the well-being of a Jewish community depends in the Argentine on the stability of government and on the prosperity of the economy. If the Argentine condition continues to be restless and revolutionary, if inflation continues to plague the economy, the standard of living of the Argentine continues to fall, there is danger that the present violence may be aggravated. If conditions stabilize, it may quickly be forgotten. If the structure of the problem of the Argentine Jewish community was familiar to anyone who has studied Jewish history, the structure of the problem which faced the Jews of the Union of South Africa was uniquely contemporary and radically new. The Jew of the Union of South Africa is faced with a new danger, and it comes to him because of the rising revolution of race, which is sweeping the world. South Africa, as you know, has moved deliberately against the current of world opinion and world morality, and where we have been attempting to develop slowly the brotherhood of race, the Union of South Africa has been moving towards the separation of the races, towards the indignity, the cruelty of apartheid. The Jewish community of the Union of South Africa has never been a fanatically racist community, nor has it approved in any major sense of the policies of the nationalist government. It is a well-placed and economically well-off community, but it has not been able to stem the political tide. It has been politically ineffective. The Union of South Africa has been progressively sealed off from the community of nations, and passions mount to a fever pitch. When Israel last year joined with almost 100 other of the nations of the world in voting in favor of a resolution introduced at the United Nations condemning the Union of South Africa for its racial policies, there was a torrent of abuse unleashed in the nationalist press of that nation against the Jewish community of that nation because Israel, a Jewish state, had so voted. Israel was lumped with what is called down there the Afro-Asian racial incubus. And threats were made that the security of the Jewish community was threatened because of Israel's position in respect to the equality of the races. Fortunately, the Prime Minister of the Union of South Africa, Dr. Boervaart, spoke out against this editorial diatribe, and the condition calmed. But the long-term future of the Jews in the Union of South Africa is dismal indeed. For they cannot for long, as cannot any of the whites of that nation, escape the cutting edge of the revolution of race. It seems improbable that a more moderate policy will be developed, one which would be enlightened and would move the Union in the direction, say, our own nation is taking. And lacking this, it would seem that the only future for the Jew, if he would escape the inevitable bloodbath, is emigration. 30,000 of the 110,000 Jews of the Union have already emigrated, most of them to the United Kingdom and to Israel. And one would hope that in the years ahead, rather quickly, young especially, will move out from their native home, where there is no future because of a politic of hate which damns and dooms this nation. But it was the fate of the Jews of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics which preoccupied the attention of the American Jewish community and of Jewish communities around the world. There are today 3 million Jews in the Soviet Union. They represent, next to the United States, the largest settlement of Jews any place on the face of the globe. Mr. Khrushchev, the Soviet state, was accused from practically every platform of a Jewish organization of conducting, last year and the year before, a considered and concerted policy of anti-Semitism, officially, on behalf of the government. The issue was one of such magnitude that it was raised before the United Nations Commission on Human Rights. It was raised by the Russophile British philosopher, Lord Bertrand Russell, in a series of correspondence which he had with Premier Khrushchev. It was raised by our own State Department and by our own president in a series of remonstrations made in Moscow at what was called the highest level. And through it all, Mr. Khrushchev maintained absolute denial. He denied categorically that there was any official program of anti-Semitism abroad of being effected in the Soviet Union. The facts would seem to belie his plea of innocence. On the other hand, the facts do not support the semi-hysterical crescendo of political denunciation which became the semi-official policy of many of our Jewish organizations. Judaism, as you know, in the Soviet Union is a statement of ethnic nationality. It is a stamp which is affixed to your passport at birth. It is a statement of your ethnic origin. It has little necessarily to do with your religious beliefs or spiritual identification. The Russian state has been, since its beginning, antagonistic to religion generally. But since Mr. Khrushchev attained power in the period which is now called the period of domestic thaw, most of the religious communions have found that they have a little elbow room, a little breathing space, that they can open new churches and undertake new activities. Not so the Jewish community. According to official Soviet statistics, there were 450 synagogues in the Soviet Union in 1956. There were 96 still open in the Soviet Union as of June of last year. The Soviet Union seems to have undertaken a policy of determined harassment of organized Jewish life. Synagogues have been closed on the grounds of violating building codes. A torrent of editorial has been unleashed against the synagogue as centers of black marketeering and of other nefarious economic activity. When the 20-some-odd students of the one seminary, the one yeshiva which still exists in the Soviet Union, in Moscow, returned to their homes for the holidays, they found that they could not renew their residence permits in Moscow and could not return from their vacations. The Soviet government has not allowed matzah to be baked for the Passover during the last several years, and this year went so far as to return to friends outside of the Union matzah which was sent in to those whom they knew of inside of Russia. Now, why should one of the greatest and most powerful states of the world undertake this niggling and demeaning policy of harassment against the Jewish community? The answer is a necessarily complicated one. It touches ancient Russian attitudes. Russia invented the pogrom. Russians wrote the Bible of modern anti-Semitism, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. Russians invented the concept of apartheid when a century and a half ago they forced the vast majority of Jews in the Soviet Union into the western marshes, into a land which was known as the Pale of the Settlement, and denied them the rights of travel and of settlement elsewhere in Greater Russia. It would seem also that the attack on the Jewish community is part of a policy which is oriented to the foreign and international scene. A major plank of Russian interest has been the wooing and the winning of Arab interest and Arab loyalties. Zionism has become identified in the Russian vocabulary with capitalist colonialism. Israel is again and again pilloried in the Soviet press. And the synagogue is accused of being a center of Zionist propaganda. It would seem also that Mr. Khrushchev requires a scapegoat for the failure of his agricultural program and for his inability to make good on his promise to raise in a dramatic fashion the standard of living of the average Soviet citizen. There have taken place in Russia in the past 2.5 years a number of economic trials. At these trials, individuals have been accused, in effect, of sabotaging Russian economic policy, of siphoning off the profit for their own pockets. 60% of those who have been condemned and executed for these economic crimes have been Jews. The Jews represent only 1.5% of the citizens of the Soviet Union. More than this, the Soviet press has seized upon the Jewishness of those who have been sentenced and has been, in effect, resurrecting Shylock, the image of the Jew capitalist, the image of the Jew saboteur, and has been broadcasting these ancient defamations throughout the length and breadth of that land. The Jew is performing his immemorial function as a scapegoat for the failures of authoritarian government. What is the future of the Jew in the Soviet Union? For the religious Jew, for the pious Jew, the future is dismal indeed. What religions still exists is old-fashioned, medieval, deliberately kept so. There can be no reform, no modernizing of the synagogue or of its teaching. And how can this religion compete, even if it is permitted to exist, how can it compete for the minds of the young who are being trained in the new era, the new spirit, the new scientific age? It would seem that the only future for the pious Jew in the Soviet Union is emigration. And indeed, when Israel presented the case against the Soviet Union to the United Nations, it was with the plea that the United Nations encouraged Russia to permit the emigration of the religious Jew, that he might join again with his spiritual brothers elsewhere. And it is inconceivable to me that the leaders of the Soviet Union will not ultimately recognize the validity of this request. What possible virtue can it have for the Russian government to restrain within its borders a million or more people who are unhappy, spiritually unhappy, with the Russian way of life. But this also must be kept in mind, that not all of the Jews of the Soviet Union are affected by this anti-religious program. Anti-Semitism is not yet a completely developed policy. Many of the 3 million labeled Jews of the Soviet Union occupy high place in the Soviet economy, in the teaching and learned professions, in the sciences, in education, in agriculture, in production, even in politics. Few of them have attained first rank, but many of them are the major officers who carry out official policy. For these Jews, it is not yet time to say Kaddish, nor can we say at this time what their Jewishness means, if anything, to them. But surely we ought to remember this, that this is a time for the scalpel, not the meat axe. That the Russian bear has a notoriously ugly temper, and that it is one thing to castigate Russia for its actions from the safety of our freedoms, and quite another to forget that 3 million Jews might be knocked over by one angry sweep of the Russian bear's paw. Russia can yet take far more violent action against its Jews. And if we push it too far, if we dig the needle in too deeply, it may yet do so. It would seem to me that the path of wisdom is to encourage the Russians to see the virtue of a policy of free emigration, so that families may be reunited, so that those to whom Judaism is a religious profession might find again an atmosphere of freedom in which to live out their lives. Russia has something to gain by such a policy, and so have we. For ultimately, Russia must appear before the bar of world public opinion. And ultimately, Russia too must appear before the bar of world communist opinion. And it is well to remember that the Bolshevik Constitution of 1921 specifically prohibits anti-Semitism as a bourgeois disease which has no place in a classless society. No, I am not yet prepared to say Kaddish for the Russian Jew. If there were danger signals abroad, there are also hopeful signs. And perhaps the most hopeful of all were some indications that the ancient abrasion of Catholic-Jewish relationships might be smoothed over. There has developed around the concept of the present Vatican Council a great deal of pressure within the church and without the church, that the church deal forthrightly and finally with its relationship with all other religious bodies, including the Jewish group. Under the auspices of Augustine Cardinal Bea, a man of rare spiritual energy and courage, a schema, our theological chapter concerning church relationships to the Jews, was introduced at the last fall session of the Ecumenical Council. This schema dealt with the Jew entirely in theological terms. It extended to him a hand of spiritual friendship as a descendant of Abraham, the first monotheist. It freed the Jew of any blame as a deicide, as the Christ killer. And it freed the Jew of the opprobrium of being called a cursed people because we had rejected that pearl beyond price, the new gospel which the Christ had taught. Now, in practical terms, these words accomplish little, but symbolically, they have tremendous value. For they represent the desire of a large majority of the clerics of the Catholic Church to encourage the new atmosphere of religious cooperation which is one of the unique characteristics of our 20th century. It is unfortunate that this schema, along with a companion chapter dealing with religious liberty, that it was not passed at the last session of the council. It is beyond our knowing what final form the schema will ultimately take when it is reintroduced in September, when the council reconvenes. But already, a 1900-year tragedy seems partially to be resolving itself. The church does not go far. It does not deny its control of the keys of the kingdom. It does not deny its sole ownership of the truth. It does not deny its missionary interests in regards to the Jewish people. But it does extend a hand of interest, of cooperation. It does make it possible for men in this diocese and elsewhere to unite as citizens, as religious people, for the common good. And it is inconceivable to me that the church, now that this door has been opened and left ajar, that it will close it again and return to the medievalism which has characterized its relationships with the Jewish community so long into the 20th century. One of the unexpected byproducts of the Ecumenical Council was the announcement by Pope Paul of his intention to visit the State of Israel. He is there now. As you know, the Vatican never recognized the State of Israel. Indeed, during the years of 1947 and 1948, the Vatican worked against the establishment of the state. It would have preferred an internationalization of the land in which the church as a political body would have had a major say. But it is to be hoped that this meeting between the Pope and the Israeli Prime Minister will go a long ways towards normalizing the relationship between these two powers, and that the church may, in the years ahead, find reason to work cooperatively with the new State of Israel for the control of all the holy shrines of the Holy Land, and that tourism, religious pilgrimage, may become an important interest of both of these groups. For Israel, 1963 was a year of sturdy growth. Inflation was finally controlled. Israel was able to make the first repayment on its bonded debt. The balance of trade narrowed and seemed to finally to be leveling off. During 1963, Israel changed both its prime minister and its president. The saintly scholar president, Yitzhak Ben Tzvi, died in April, and he's replaced in office by another scholar diplomat, Zalman Shazar. Later in the year, David Ben-Gurion, the indefatigable prime minister of the state since its inception, retired, probably because of age, and he was replaced by his finance minister, Mr. Levi Eshkol. Neither of these changes was of political moment. And Israel continued to be ruled by a center-left coalition, which has brought a great deal of strength and economic prosperity to the nation. The crucial problem of Israel remained in 1963 what it had been in the years before, the problem of defense and security. 1963 was a year of revolution, of unrest throughout the Near East. Governments were overthrown in the Yemen, in Iraq, in Syria. And Mr. Nasser attempted to fish in these troubled waters to forge a band of iron, a united military command around and against the State of Israel. He was not noticeably successful. But during the year, Russia continued to pour into the Near East, into the Arab lands of the Near East, vast quantities of highly sophisticated weapons, supersonic planes and fast submarines, ground-to-air missiles and the like. And this continuing unbalancing of the military picture was a matter of grave concern. So much so that our own government, in the spring of the year, finally permitted the sale of some Hawk ground-to-air missiles to the State of Israel in order to right the balance of power. Russia plays a devil's game in the Near East. Russia is supplying the nations of that part of the world with arms which can have only one purpose: to rain death and destruction down upon the little state. And it was gratifying to hear 2 weeks ago Secretary of State of the United States, Mr. Dean Rusk, pledging the interest of our government in the continuing vigorous existence of the State of Israel as an outgrowth of our own national interest and national policy. By and large, the relations between Israel and the United States throughout 1963 were close and intimate. Perhaps the most ominous story of 1963 spotlighted the work of some 500 West German scientists and technicians who had been hired by the Egyptian government to perfect for it a nuclear missile system. One had the vision of Nazism reborn. One could not erase from his mind the memory of German racial hatred. One could not but feel that the game was not yet up, that Nazi ideology was still alive, demonic, forceful in our world. Great pressure was brought by the State of Israel to the West German government to try and have these 500 merchants of death recalled, to no avail. Germany was surprisingly unwilling to insist that she was pure, purged of the curse of racism. Year's end, 500 technicians and scientists were still busily at work in Egypt. At year's end, men of ill will, Egypt, Syria, Iraq, Yemen, were still determined on the extermination of this little state. I close with this story, not because I fear for the existence of the State of Israel, I do not. Not because I fear for the continued existence of the Jewish people, I do not. No one who has seen the renewal of Judaism in our own nation and the rebirth of Israel can but be confident. But I close with this story because I think it is a necessary, cruel truth. Evil exists in our world. Evil is abroad. We forget this fact to our own peril. It is so easy sometimes to push oneself off from the world to some comfortable, placid backwater, and to forget that life is essentially, today as it has always been, a struggle. A struggle between privilege and justice, between ignorance and courage, between greed and decency. I do not fear for the good. To admit evil is not to admit the victory of evil. To admit evil is simply to admit the imperative of alertness. The Jewish people in 1963 cannot afford to let down their guard. The Jewish people in 1963 must continue to be concerned with the well-being of their co-religionists throughout the world. The Jewish people in 1963 must continue to remind the nations where they live that if they tolerate oppression or hatred any place in the globe, they are ultimately undercutting their own security. I close with this story because it is well to remember that in life there are no guarantees. Life is not a fairy story where the young man and the young woman live happily ever after. There can be happiness. There can be a grand and glorious future if we make it, if we establish it, if we are prepared to sacrifice for it. But simply to hope, to build castles in the air, to dream, lo zu haderech, that is not the way. 1963 was a typical year in our religious pilgrimage. It was a year of hope and a year of danger. It was a year of prosperity and it was a year of restlessness. For some there was security, others were uprooted. It was a year in which the Jewish people had to confront, as they have every year of their history, the reality. The hopeful yet cruel reality which is life. And confront it we did. Confront it we must.